This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We're just coming off the Labor Day holiday. The long weekend included historic commemorations of an important time in Hawaii history. Onipa'a celebrations to honor Queen Liliuokalani's birthday were held on the grounds of Iolani Palace. That is where HPR reporter Ku'uwehi Hirashi was. She joins us live.
That's right. Good morning, Catherine. I got to go to Iolani Palace this weekend on Sunday for an all-day celebration of music, hula. A lot of our community organizations were out providing information, but also some of the cultural practices were up and alive, like kui'ai and lauhala weaving and whatnot. But I wanted to go around and ask folks this very pointed but I think sensitive question sometimes about whether or not they believe Queen Liliuokalani's nonviolent approach, so her reaction to the initial overthrow of her kingdom, whether or not that was the right decision in terms of not fighting. For those who might not be familiar, Queen Liliuokalani did decide to not take up arms against forces that were heavily armed, including several sailors from the USS Boston, American sailors that were out there in the harbor. She decided not to fight against them, and through that sort of, through that approach, we are where we are today. And so went around and asked folks, what do you think? Was this the right decision, or do you think she should have fought? And this is what they had to say.
I believe that it was. Certainly there could have been more opposition leading to more disaster, I think, within our kingdom, loss of life. But no, I think at the time it was the right decision.
Yes, I totally agreed on her nonviolent approach. It did save her people. It may not have turned out the way she wanted, which is kind of sad.
I think it was the correct decision for the people of Hawaii at that time. You got to remember you had all these foreign warships out there, including the Americans, who would have devastated our populations even more. She did the right thing and she went through the right channels. Even I believe it was President Grover Cleveland. And they agreed and they wanted to return our kingdom, but there were outside forces within their own American politics that was going on that kept that from happening.
Right. So going through history a lot, I feel a lot more information and education about the actual history of Hawaii. I've seen it at least in this past event. So that was Suli Stroud of Utah, Gail Fung of Kaimuki, and Ernest Carvalho of Kohala on the Big Island. And that last point by Ernest Carvalho saying that there was this initial intent to restore the monarchy on behalf of President Grover Cleveland. What happened after that was a change in rank and file. So there was President McKinley. We have McKinley High School named after who came in, and then that restoration of the monarchy did not happen. But Leilani Kupahu Marino Kahuano now, Kimo Kahuano's wife, got to speak to her about some of the history, and she came up with a really interesting sort of look back 50 years prior to the overthrow, to the 1843 episode that King Kamehameha III had here in Hawaii, where sovereignty was taken by the British for 4 months and then restored after that 4 months after diplomatic sort of conversations getting going. But this is what Kahuano had to say about that particular incident.
We know who we are as Hawaiians. We have a commitment to what it means to be pono. And so she did what was pono. And she believed that the United States would do the same thing. If you think about 50 years earlier, in 1843, I believe that she thought the same thing would happen as the British had come to realize the recognition of the monarchy being restored.
Right. So, you know, the only sort of event in recent history that we can think of for Queen Liliuokalani at the time was this once, you know, this 4 month occupation. And it turned out to be an incident where sovereignty was restored. And so thinking that she could do the same thing in you know, with what she knew, she tried to reach out to Congress, U.S. Congress, and also to the presidents at the time, and any sort of diplomatic ties she might have to other countries to help her restore her monarchy. But that did not happen. So in drawing parallels, though, this is interesting. So in drawing parallels between today's movement, nonviolent direct action, also known as Kapu Aloha, this code of conduct that's very much alive and well up on Mauna Kea, with those calling themselves Kia'ia protectors, that sort of peaceful movement in speaking to folks has this sort of rooted effect in what Queen Liliuokalani did, in that approach of believing in what is pono, what is right and just, and doing what you can to make sure that comes about. And speaking to Kahu Kaleo Patterson, who teaches peace studies up at UH, he was also at the event. Interesting perspective from him. So he teaches Gandhi, he'll teach a Martin Luther King, and this idea of nonviolent approaches to activism. And from his perspective, these things just take time. So the idea that Queen Liliuokalani had sort of set the stage for, you know, peace being the approach that she should take, that her people should take, that continues on in Kahu Patterson's eyes in today's Kapu Aloha movement.
The King Ying guys like to say that nonviolence is not just passivity. It's not just not doing anything or being nice, but nonviolence as a strategy, a social change strategy, is fighting back. And you have to fight back, but you're fighting back with different tools, tools that are nonviolent, tools that are not going to hurt or harm people, but tools that are going to change people the way they think. And Gandhi would say, we're fighting, but we're not fighting to overcome an enemy or an opponent. We're fighting to put our truth alongside with somebody else's truth and to come up with a new truth together, yeah? And so it's very important right now for our people to become the experts in the world on nonviolence direct action.
So an interesting perspective, especially from Kahu Patterson, having sort of studied, you know, different peace movements and social movements through nonviolence.
It is interesting, too, when you look at the history here in Hawaii, and then you look at current day protests like what we're seeing in Hong Kong, and you see the violence there.
Exactly. And they've spoken about that here. I think a lot of our political leaders and even law enforcement in the particular issue with Mauna Kea have taken very special control to handle things diplomatically instead of doing, yes, what we're seeing here in Hong Kong.
Yeah. And the arrests that we saw at Mauna Kea, law enforcement very careful to treat the kupuna with respect, you know, handling very gingerly as they escorted them off the mountain, all those extra steps taken.
I think there's a lot to be said for the number of Native Hawaiians that are in law enforcement that sort of take that extra care, but also I think just the general respect for the indigenous people of Hawaii that I think is kind of unparalleled in other areas here in the United States.
Yeah, so it's fascinating history, fascinating to look back at what has happened with the Onipa'a celebrations. But thank you very much, Kuve.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking to HBR's Kuve Hirashi about the history of Kapu Aloha. You can find her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Foodland's Give Aloha program makes it easy to donate to your favorite charity, and it matches your gift. Shop at any Foodland, Sack and Save, and Foodland Farm stores this month, and designate Hawaii Public Radio at checkout. Your donation helps to sustain our statewide public service, and along with your groceries, you'll take home our big mahalo.
Stocks closed sharply lower on Wall Street today, the first day back in business after the U.S. tariffs on certain Chinese goods took effect. China has responded with retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. It's an uneasy time. China's industrial strategy is outlined in a plan called Made in China 2025, and the Trump administration says it includes features like intellectual property theft, forced technology transfers, and cyber espionage. Boy Lucha is an industrial sociologist at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou and a visiting scholar at the East-West Center here in Honolulu. His research focuses on China's industrial economy, and he recently spoke about the Made in China 2025 plan with HPR's Ryan Finnerty as part of an ongoing series exploring the U.S.-China trade war.
Made in China 2025 is the major plan for industrial modernization that China has launched in 2015. And it's a comprehensive plan to develop technology and manufacturing expertise in 10 major emerging industries in which China hopes to acquire the role of a world market leader. This includes robotics and industrial automation, advanced information technologies, chip making, new energy systems and vehicles in particular, ocean technology, and a few more related fields. And this is the blueprint for the digitalized or digital factory of the future, which is completely based on the internet and on interconnection of all the major points of production and the supply chains. It's also known as the Internet of Things.
And so how does the plan, the 2025 plan, play into the trade war, the ongoing trade tensions between the United States and China?
Well, when the Chinese government set up this plan about 5 years ago, nobody was talking about trade wars. And it pretty much became the object of the trade war through the American government, because the American government started to target it or to create it as a target in the trade war, culminating in the demand that China should withdraw the whole program. The Trump administration has been using it massively as a bargaining chip, and to a certain extent it has been successful, because the Chinese government has scaled down the rhetoric and the public emphasis on this program. Many internal government documents now in China no longer talk about Made in China 2025. Of course, they are still going on, but rhetorically, the Chinese government withdrew from this partially.
What was it about the plan? What aspects of it attracted negative attention from the American side?
Well, that's mainly about subsidies and about state-owned enterprise and the so-called national champions. So the suspicion was that China would create national champions in key industries that would take industrial property from all over the world and from the United States, and that would be subsidized through the government. When you look at the real structure of the Made in China 2025 program and how the process develops, most of this is unsubstantiated. Because, number one, the program, the Made in China program, does not support or aim at supporting specific companies or picking companies as becoming the national champion. This is like Korea, South Korea did it in the 1980s, or also Japan did it in the 70s and 80s. It's very different in nature. Made in China 2025 clearly has a perspective on industrial chains and production networks, and to develop production infrastructures for the specific sectors on a sectoral base. Yeah? And the second thing is, the program is not focused on state-owned enterprises. This is the usual perception of the Western media and transported through all the trade war rhetoric. If you look at most of these industries under Made in China 2025, the major players, the champions, so to speak, are private or semi-private companies, like typically Huawei in telecommunications, or like Midea, or like Haier in household appliances, or In the car industry, it's no longer the state-owned enterprises, the Chinese state-owned car makers who are in joint ventures with the major Western manufacturers like Volkswagen or General Motors. But it's the new players, the Chinese independent car makers or privately owned producers of batteries or electric vehicles like BYD. And so you can say, in most of these sectors, the Chinese government has to rely on private companies as the lead companies. And of course, whether they can play the role as a national champion or not will also be decided by international competition and the market and their ability to establish technological and brand name leadership in the markets. But this is very different from the traditional pick winners and pick industrial champions from the winners.
So it sounds like the plan is moving away from that state-dominated capitalism model that we had seen in China and towards something closer to a free market.
The plan itself, in my eyes, is already a departure from the classical state capitalist industrial policies of the 1990s and the early 2000s. It's the first time that China's new multinational enterprises like Huawei, that they play a key role. Also the big data platform providers, Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, they are involved in many, many ways in this program, and they are the essential drivers of many of the program and the owners of the key technologies. And that's why Made in China in itself, in my eyes, already has been a major departure or major difference to the traditional programs of industrial policy in China.
You mentioned during your presentation that one area where the plan is kind of lacking is on the human side and the development of human capital. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think this is the key deficit. The plan itself, Made in China 2025, and its many, many sub-plans and also its local implementation plans, they do mention human resource development as important for industrial competitiveness, industrial upgrading of China, but there are no specific strategies on these topics whatsoever under the Made in China 2025 program. This whole thing is unaddressed, and there's a very technocratic vision, of course, of industrial modernization.
So how do you think this conflict, this trade war, plays out? Is it going to just be a blip in history, or are we seeing the beginning of a permanent split economically between the United States and China?
Certainly, this is not a blip in history, and it's very clear. The Trump administration has expressed this again and again. It's about a comprehensive geostrategic confrontation between China and the U.S., and it's about containing China's role as an emerging world power. That's the thing. So it's about politics. Yeah? It took a long time for the Chinese leadership to realize this. It was only in 2017-18 when the Trump administration started to cut off the Chinese telecommunications company ZTE from U.S.-designed or U.S.-made or Taiwan-made, U.S.-Taiwan-made chips. And the Chinese leadership, in my eyes, really tried to rely on its very good relationships with core groups of American business, talking the Boeings and the Apples and the Microsofts and the Starbucks. But obviously, these companies are no longer the relevant players in shaping this administration's trade policy. This is something the Chinese leadership was very slow to understand.
So in your assessment, can this strategy work, or will it only serve to make China more dominant, more powerful in the long run?
It will certainly drive some changes in China. The one thing is we have to say first, the global technology chains and the global production chains and the global innovation systems, they cannot really be decoupled. This is just impossible, especially in industries like IT, where the chips are designed by U.S. companies like Qualcomm or Intel, and they are made by big chip contract manufacturers in Taiwan, and they are sold and used in China by companies like Huawei. And there's so many examples for this. Any smartphone, let's say an Apple smartphone, it's a global product in this sense. We cannot turn the clock back on this. But of course, this whole trade war is not about economic rationality. It's about politics. Yeah. So this is more like a political topic. And when you raise the stakes for trade and intellectual property and all these things, it's easier to keep it cooking. And I think this is the main function of the whole trade war as we see it today.
All right, well, Professor Luthi, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Boy Luchu is an industrial sociologist at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, China, and a former visiting scholar at the East-West Center in Honolulu. We'll have a link to his research on Chinese industrial policy at hawaiipublicradio.org. The state of our prisons, a priority for lawmakers following the riot on Maui triggered by overcrowding. That's the subject of today's Reality Check. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Yu Hyun Jung on the line today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Yeah, so your article talks about a new oversight commission that's been slow to put together.
That's right. So in the previous legislative session, the legislature passed an oversight commission, which was a key recommendation by the HCR 85 Prison Reform Task Force. They actually previously released a very lengthy reform report that included other recommendations. But one of it was that you guys needed to bring your stuff together and create an independent oversight body, and the legislature delivered. And Governor Ige signed the bill, and it became Act 179. It has other measures also, but it establishes this oversight commission for the correctional system. And that happened in July, but thus far, only 2 out of the 5 people who are supposed to be on this board have been appointed, and no oversight coordinator, the only salaried position who's supposed to be serving this board, has not been hired yet.
I'm surprised, because I would have thought after talking about this for so long, they would have had some names, on a list and be ready to go once the governor signed this thing.
That's what one would think, but thus far, only 2 people, and those 2 people are, so Office of Hawaiian Affairs was the first entity to put out a name, and that was only days after the governor signed this bill. And the name they put forward is Mark Kawika Patterson, who is the administrator at the Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility. And this guy is basically a lifetime corrections professional. He was the women's facilities administrator at one point, and he worked at Halawa facility. He's worked at OCCC. Though I will mention that in 2017, the Star Advertiser had an article criticizing him for his approaches, because he did get rid of some therapeutic programs at the youth facility. I interviewed him, and he said that those programs have been replaced since then, and he does have a vision for a more therapeutic approach now.
And so who is the second appointee?
The second appointee is retired judge Ronald Ibarra of the Big Island, and he was also a former Hawaii County Corporation Counsel and also prosecutor in Kona.
And so, what are they saying about the other positions that need to get filled?
That they just haven't been filled. And so this oversight commission, for administrative purposes only, so for basically bureaucratic purposes only, is housed under the Attorney General's office. And the Attorney General's office has to deal with a lot of other boards that they're not budgeted for. This board actually has a budget. This commission, rather, has a budget. For this fiscal year, they have $160,000, or about $160,000. That should cover the salary of this one position, the oversight coordinator. The commissioners do not get paid, but the 3 other commissioners who have to be appointed thus far should be appointed by the governor, the Senate president and the House speaker, and we just don't know when that's going to happen or who they're going
to
be.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who they finally select. And is there a deadline as to when they've got to kind of get off the ground here?
There is no deadline, which is, you know, maybe something the statute should have had. Mm. The statute says nothing about when these people should be appointed, which is why they can do this. But there is, however, a deadline for when this oversight coordinator should be starting, which is December 1st.
Okay.
So by December 1st, this oversight coordinator has to start. So at least there's a deadline for that.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens then. But thanks so much. That was reporter Yoo Hyun Jung with today's Reality Check. To read the prison story and more, visit civilbeat.org. Study out comparing marathons across the country and the globe has found that Hawaii has the slowest running times of 6 hours and 16 minutes. Florida and Alaska join us at the bottom of the list. Run Repeat shared the data of the worldwide marathon statistics that were released yesterday. The average age of a Honolulu Marathon runner is 42 years old. We talked to Jim Barahal, CEO of the Honolulu Marathon, this morning about the trends.
The more competitive marathons, shall we say, or historically, the marathons that have been around a long time, Boston, New York, Chicago, the very competitive marathons really around the world have all been either in the fall or the spring. If you count London, Berlin, all of these marathons are all either in the fall or the spring. And the reason for that is to try to capture ideal weather for running your fastest marathon. And so the ideal temperature is probably somewhere around 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So the Honolulu Marathon, by being in December and being in a tropical area, is already an outlier and has always been that way because you'll never get the ideal temperature to run a fast marathon. You put all that together, kind of the laid-back Hawaii, warmer weather, and no time limit, and lots of first-time marathoners, especially from Japan, and the average time will be slower than any other marathon.
Right, but you folks also clocked the fastest times in the U.S., correct, recently?
Yes, in 2016 and 2017, our men's winner, Lawrence Tirono, actually had the fastest time in the United States. His winning time here was faster than the winning time in Boston, New York, and Chicago for those 2 years. A bit of an anomaly, but still amazing. Tirono was clearly somebody who broke through in Honolulu, and last year he won the Boston Marathon. So he's clearly a guy that's possibly, you know, the number two marathoner in the world. And our women's time, both those years, was the second fastest time in the United States. And that was a lady named Bridget Koske from Kenya, who subsequently has won the Chicago Marathon and is probably the number one female marathoner in the world. So we do get the great runners as well. But I think the heart and soul of the race is the person out there just trying to achieve their goal, whatever it is. And we have a pretty broad canvas in which you can paint your own marathon accomplishment on there. Last year, our last finisher was over 18 hours, and he was a 88-year-old gentleman from Japan. So it's open for everybody. We let everybody define what they're trying to accomplish out there. Sometimes it's real slow, and sometimes it's real fast. So it's really fun.
Now, the Honolulu Marathon, it was always regarded as the people's race. It was started as a race for every man.
Right. And I think that's a no-time-limit philosophy. And if you think about it, if you traveled around a marathon and there's a time limit, and a race like New York would have a 7-hour time limit, Boston, I think, is 6 hours, you don't want to travel somewhere and then either get taken off the course or not be listed as an official finisher. So for somebody who is not sure if they can even finish the marathon, and quite frankly, that's most people who have never run a marathon, your first marathon, unless you're a world-class runner, your thought is, I just want to finish. But I think it takes a lot of pressure off knowing that, you know, whatever happens out there, if you're having a bad day or you cramp up or, you know, you have to start walking, whatever happens out there, if you can hang in there, you'll finish and you get your finisher shirt and you get your medal and you'll be listed as an official finisher. So I love that part of it. I love the no time limit. The city has been great in working with us to allow us to be out on the road so that we do start closing the roads. And we do stay out there for the last finisher. It's actually a very inspirational and moving little ceremony when the last finisher comes across.
It really is. I mean, I recall my first marathon and, you know, as you're coming down on Kalani on the Ole Highway, and then you see the fastest runner, you know, and everybody's cheering him on. And then I remember coming back toward the finish line, and there was the last, you know, runner or walker. But it is, you kind of get, you know, the speed demons and the pokey papas, you know, at the very end.
Yeah. But I think everybody feels the same. I've always felt that way, even from my own running career. I feel that everybody is going at the limit of their ability on that day, their aerobic threshold, as it were, whether that's running sub 5 minutes a mile or walking 20 minutes a mile. I think everybody's doing the best they can. So oddly, it feels the same for everybody. I know from my own running experiences, my best races, my fastest times are often the easiest for me. I felt the best. So I never think just because somebody's going slower that it's somehow easier for them. Actually, I think it's quite a bit harder.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's very difficult to be out there for 10, 12 hours.
Oh, yes, so, it is. And I think just the encouragement that everybody gets, whether you're the fastest or the slowest, you know, it really is the spirit, the Aloha spirit, right? But maybe more so here, I don't know. And there's always the encouragement for people doing their, you know, their personal goals, trying to obtain their personal goals. But it's a fun race too.
Yeah, I mean, that's what people tell me. I know from my own experiences running the marathon a long time ago. You know, it's tough stuff. So I'm always amazed at the thousands of people that come out every year and the great spirit out there, and they do seem to have a good time. But I think it's that sense of accomplishment. I think most people at some point when they do a marathon at whatever speed have that moment of truth out there where they're wondering if they're going to finish. And I think you learn a lot about yourself when you do the marathon. You do go through some changes over the course of however many hours it takes you to finish. And I think when you do finish that marathon, it gives you a great sense of accomplishment. It gives you confidence in life, not only for fitness and sports stuff, but in every aspect of your life. I think it's a great thing.
Well, the images are burned in my brain are, you know, the group of Japanese girls that are stopping at the curbside to reapply mascara. Just lots of good fun.
Yeah, it's very different. Honolulu is very different. It's a great place for people to run their first marathon, and in many cases, especially our runners from Japan, it's the only marathon they're ever going to run. And obviously, since the Honolulu Marathon began back in 1973, there's literally thousands of marathons now around the country and around the world. And so, for a long time, there were only elite races in Japan, maybe 200 people. And so a recreational Japanese runner or a fitness runner or somebody just wanted to do a bucket list, finish a marathon, Honolulu was really the only opportunity they had. In the last 10 years, there's now dozens of people's marathons in Japan. So it's made it a lot tougher for the Honolulu Marathon as a competitive race to attract people from Japan. But we still managed to bring in, you know, quite a great number. And I think that no time limit is very important. It's a unique thing, and I think it helps to keep the event really strong and special.
No, I think years ago, I think when I was interviewing you for KITV when we covered the race, I don't think you got any funding from HTA. Do you get any tourism money at all?
No, we don't get any funding. Our funding comes from our sponsors and the entry fees. And so that's how we keep going.
And so what's ahead?
What I've always said is, you find the marathon as much as the marathon finds you. I think, of course, we market and promote the event, but I think there's something, you know, when people are ready to take on that kind of challenge, and it often happens or begins at a certain point in someone's life, often in the 20s and 30s, especially if people have played sports or they get into a lifestyle that's a little more sedentary than it was when they were younger. And the marathon is kind of sitting up there. People are really aware of it. So it's an interesting combination. I think people will always find the marathon. I do think that that'll always be there. I think as people get older, they may gravitate towards shorter distances. And we have this Start to Park 10K, which starts with the marathon. An interesting part of our course, and this is kind of a fluke, really, is that the first 10K takes you back to Kapi'olani Park. So this Start to Park 10K now that we used to call the race day walk, has gotten quite big. I think we're going to approach 8,000 people in that. And we've noticed that a lot of local former marathoners are now signing up for this 10K instead. So we're kind of moving in a direction where we're going to have the 10K inside the marathon, and the numbers are actually going to grow. If you combine the Start to Park with the marathon, we think we're going to approach in another 3 years probably 35 to 40,000 people. So I think the event is going to grow, but it's not all going to be on the marathon side, but people still want to be a part of that. And it's hard to push the marathon, you know, too hard, because either somebody wants to do it or they don't want to do it.
Right, and you still do the Merry Mile, too, right? So there's something for everyone.
We do the Merry Mile the day before, which is really a fun event, the 1 mile. And that's a lot of that is for friends and relatives, people that come for the marathon, and probably a lot of marathoners, too. And that's growing rapidly, especially in Japan. That event is up over 200% in Japan this year. So we're expecting about 3,000 in the mile this year. So we've evolved as the sport has evolved, and we understand that some people will move into the marathon and some people will move out of the marathon. So we want to have something, you know, for everyone who's interested in having that experience. And so it's been very exciting, and I think our growth is ahead of us, but you do make a good point that not everybody's going to run marathons their whole life, and that's okay.
We've been talking with Jim Barahal, CEO of the Honolulu Marathon. For links to the study and more, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with this week's Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our very small planet, and also what we may try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, joined by astronomer Christopher Phillips and his expertise, which we are welcoming back right now. Hey, Chris, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the southern sky after sunset. Also, the moon this week is passing through its first quarter phase, meaning our skies will still be dark enough to spot those faint objects in the heavens.
Now, you've dug up a story on a planet we don't hear about a whole lot, and that's Venus.
Oh, yes. There's some interesting speculation from the planet Venus this week, as dark patches spotted in the Venusian clouds have caught the eye of planetary scientists. Speculation is rife as to the nature of these patches and what exactly their role is in regards to the weather on Venus. One thing is for sure, they are absorbing a great deal of solar radiation, which is rather strange indeed. And they absorb so much of it, they may actually be affecting the global weather on Venus.
And what do the researchers think the clouds could be made of?
Well, there are several suspected causes, one of which could be very exciting indeed. Firstly, they could be made of something quite mundane, such as sulfur or a compound known as ferric chloride. Another possibility that's really interesting is that these patches are made up of microorganisms floating in the upper atmosphere of Venus.
And not that it's a real likely possibility, but something like clouds of locust or maybe a smaller creature?
But way smaller. These would be microscopic, but incredible in number.
Right. And something alive, though, is what this sort of wild and out there theory might be thinking about.
Absolutely.
And when we say that, though, these would have to be some tough little critters, because that place is not exactly life-friendly.
Well, you would think, but the idea of life on Venus is not a new one. The famous astronomer Carl Sagan proposed such a theory back in 1963, and planetary scientists are quick not to rule out the possibility, especially since it's thought that liquid water may have existed on Venus for around 2 billion years.
And I'm guessing, though, the way this has turned out most times on Stargazer, that there is another more likely possibility that you're thinking it could be.
Yes, of course, there's always the possibility that this is a natural phenomenon that we're seeing. We know so little about the weather on Venus and the processes that drive it. We really need to explore this in more depth, perhaps with a drone in the future, which is actually something that's being proposed. And then, once we get into the clouds of Venus, we can find out exactly what this mysterious phenomenon is.
And who was it that observed it?
So this was observed by a team at the Center for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the Technical University of Berlin.
Well, we'll be hoping for more news from them, and we appreciate the story here. It's Christopher Phillips and another fun Stargazer. Thank you.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can look for Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We are continuing the thread of fitness this morning. Joining us is Kirk Fritz. He's the race director for an upcoming event on Oahu's west side at the Ko'olina Resort. Four Seasons Hotel is playing host to the fundraiser for Kapi'olani Women's and Children's Hospital. It includes a triathlon and an aquathon, opportunities to get your keiki into fitness early. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what is an aquathon?
You know, that's a really cool name, isn't it? It reminds me of Aquaman. But it incorporates swimming first and then running after that. So you come right out of the water, you run right up, get your running shoes on, and off you go. Various distances. So we have that for the adults. They will be running, they will be swimming 600 meters and then running a full 5K. So it's quite a little, you know, sprint endeavor. But then we also have two different smaller versions for two different smaller demographics, if you will. We have a 10 to 14-year-old class, which will be a much shorter distance. And then the little ones under 10 years old will also be doing a smaller version of that.
Okay, so it's really a chance for your whole family to get involved.
Yeah. Race Ko'olina, presented by Four Seasons, is completely family-friendly. There's an event for all ages. So we encourage the entire family to come out. There's also the opportunity to stay at Four Seasons. So Four Seasons is offering the best rates of the entire year to participants, families of the event for Friday night, Saturday night, as well as Sunday night.
Okay, so you can really make it a big weekend, just kind of a staycation.
You can. That's kind of the essence of what we wanted to do, is bring people out to Ko'olina for the entire weekend. Many people, especially those in East Oahu, probably never have even gone out there. Maybe they went to a high school graduation dance or something out there. But so much has changed out at Ko'olina Resort. So much has built up, and the Four Seasons is just such a relaxing, enticing place to be. We want people to come out and experience the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to see that you're welcoming the community in for these events, and you're putting on these races. This is, what, the third year that you've done this?
This is the third year, and it's built up every year. Last year, we had about 650 total participants. This year, our goal is to get up to about 800, possibly 900, because we have the five events, the sprint triathlon, the adult aquathon, the keiki aquathon for the two age groups that we mentioned, the 5K and the 10K, and the 5K can actually be walked as well. So we changed our courses this year to have more capacity for the 5K and the 10K runs. There, even though we have the best athletes coming from all over the island and some from off island, it's really about the first timer. So the triathlon specifically, 85% of the people who sign up for the triathlon are actually first timers. So it's a perfect first-time event. The course is relatively flat all the way around. Even our keiki 1K at the end of all of our events, when everybody's pretty much finished, we have an amazing little, you could call it the toddler 1K, if you will. And that is loops around our finish line area. And everyone is invited to kind of participate in that. But it is actually an official event. You do register for it for the kids. They get a finisher's medal and a shirt just like everybody else does.
Okay. And joining us in our studios is a young athlete that you've got in tow.
Yes. My wife and I, Rachel, we're so blessed. We've been married 20 years coming up next June. We have five children, so I have my number four with me. This is Jeremiah.
Hi, Jeremiah.
Hey.
So you've done this race before?
Yes, I have.
And so what's the most fun thing about it?
Well, last year, the year before last year, it was really good. Like, there's free shave ice. There's a biggest inflatable water slide on the whole state of Hawaii.
Whoa.
So it's going to be really fun.
Yeah, that's a finish line feature that we have as well. So when you go into the back of the Four Seasons Resort, there's a ballroom back there called the Ko'olina Ballroom. It's actually 50,000 square feet. This year, because of all the numbers we're expecting, we have the entire ballroom, but they have what's called the Grand Lawn. And the largest inflatable water slide in the entire state, Most High Jump is the company that provides that to us. They're the only ones that have this. It is, I think, almost 2.5, almost 3 stories high.
Wow.
Yeah. And so everybody who comes into our finish line area, and it's actually shaped like a big giant wave. So they have to run around that before they go into the finish and then immediately can go back and go down the slide. So we have a lot of fun at the finish line.
Yeah, so you get hot and then you get cool.
Exactly right. Everybody can cool off. So they work real hard and then they can cool off and have a lot of fun. The expo, if you will, and the finish line area, that whole ballroom will be completely filled. We're going to have massage therapy there. We're going to have a whole Keiki Cove. We'll have live music. Four Seasons puts it on for us like no other. A full breakfast is provided. And then we're going to have random prizes. Of course, awards for those that do get top three in each of the age groups and the overalls and in the five events. It's going to be a blast.
Okay, so that event is happening toward the end of the month so people can start to make their plans now?
Yeah, we want people. That's the thing. We do have limited capacity in each one of the events. So we do want people to register now. This is the time. The event is September 22nd. Sunday. And again, we invite everybody to come out and stay for the weekend. But the time is now. They want to go to, for everything having to do with Ko'olina, so they can get a feel for what Ko'olina is all about, is go to ko'olina.com. Very easy. And then also to directly register, you want to go to bokahawaii.com, which is B-O-C-A, hawaii.com.
Okay, so they're helping you, to put this on as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, Haul and Hina and their whole production team down there with Boca Hawaii is just, they are so awesome in what they do. We've been partners for years. I used to race triathlon back in the day with Haul. He was my original coach for triathlon. We've been friends for going on, I think, 25, 30 years now.
And I've taken a swim class from him, so yeah, I know.
He's good. Fantastic. Yeah, and so we just get together, and the collective team between myself, Haul Hina, Boca Hawaii, and the Four Seasons crew is just second to none.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We've been talking to Kirk Fritz, race director for Race Ko'olina, and his son Jeremiah. That race scheduled for September 22nd.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Piano Planet, home of Steinway, also featuring Roland, Yamaha, and Kauai Pianos, located on Nimitz Highway in the Na Lama Kukui Building. Learn more at pianoplanethawaii.com.
Hi, Ray Cruz here, host of Latin Beat. Join me Saturday, September 7th, for a members-only event in HPR's Atherton Studio. It's a Latin jazz concert with Freddie Miranda Jr. and his knockout band, plus a pre-show reception with the artist. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
Well, that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we turn our attention on good guys. Good bugs, that is. We've been focusing a lot on the bad bugs and non-native invaders this summer, so the good bugs want equal time. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.